Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the Coen brothers' movie, Inside Llewyn Davis, there's a funny scene where Llewyn and the gang are recording a song. It's a novelty song, written by his friend, who's played by Justin Timberlake, and since it's taking place in, like, 1961, it's a novelty song about the space race. Now, the soundtrack to Inside Llewyn Davis is full of great performances of some great old folk songs, but this little oddity, written for the film, is the track most people were talking about when the movie was released.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
1 second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Don't shoot me in the outer space.
Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Don't shoot me in the outer space.
I sweat when they stuff me in the pressure suits. Rubble, helmet, flash, board, and boots. Nowhere up there.
Outer?
In gravity
space.
Zero. I need to breathe.
Outer?
Don't need to be a
space.
Hero. Are you reading me loud and clear? Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Please, Mr. Kennedy, from the Coen brothers movie Inside Llewyn Davis. It's actually a perfect send-up of early 60s novelty songs because putting satellites, and eventually even people, into orbit was something like a global obsession. And we know that because there genuinely were hit songs about satellites. We'll hear one of them, an unexpected hit song about, believe it or not, the Telstar communications satellite. It's another installment of our series, That Was a Hit, and it's coming up later. Speaking of unexpected chart success, I don't think anyone saw this coming in 2005 when a Hasidic reggae artist and rapper named Modest Yahoo broke into the top 40 with this song.
I give myself to you from the essence of my being, and I sing to my God. Songs of love and healing, I want Mashiach now. Time it starts a feeling. What's this feeling? My love will be holy in the ceiling. I give myself to you from the essence of my being, and I sing to my God. Songs of love and healing, I want Mashiach now.
That's Modest Yahoo's hit single, King Without a Crown. Now, the last time he visited us, at the end of 2011, Modest Yahoo had just shaved off his signature beard and side locks, calling it an evolution in his religious thought. Now, 3 years later, those still evolving views are documented on his new album, Akeda. Modest Yahoo joins me now with his band to perform some songs from that album. This first one is called Broken Car. Modest Yahoo live on Soundcheck.
Welcome to my broken car. It don't move fast, it goes so far. You might bang your head or scrape your toes. Fred Flintstone, my feet on through the holes. But don't you worry now, don't you worry. It will get you there, where you need to go, where you need to go, where do you need to go?
Over the hillsides and the valleys far and wide, where the sun go and the sky it shines. To my broken home, the It's not so fancy, made from sticks and stones. It's often empty, hope you like to be alone. You could stare out the window until you find your zone. Take cover from the bombs and the bullets. Take time to heal your wounds. Forget what they told you now. Just listen on to the tunes. Listening to the tunes.
Song's called Broken Car, and you will find it on the latest album by Modest Yahoo, the record called Akeda. Although that's a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. Modest Yahoo and his band, with Joe Tomino on drums, Rob Marsher playing keyboards, Aaron Dugan on guitar, and Stu Brooks playing the bass. Modest, welcome back to Soundcheck. Good
Thanks.
To see you.
Good to be back.
So, am I saying this title right? Akeda, A-K-E-D-A.
Yes.
What does that title refer to?
It refers to the story in the Bible of Abraham, his final test from God, bringing his son up the mountain to be slaughtered.
So the binding of Isaac.
Yes, correct. The binding of Isaac. Yeah.
A great story told in song many times over. Leonard Cohen, of course.
Oh, I didn't know that. Does he do that?
You have to hear The Story of Isaac. It is one of his great songs.
The Story of Isaac?
The Story of Isaac.
Okay.
Oh, it's one of his great songs.
I'm on it.
Doubles as a kind of an anti-war song, too, because it was early Leonard Cohen.
I'm curious his take on it.
Yeah.
Because it's a confusing story.
Well, it is kind of. So what was your take on the story? Because, as you say, it is... Well, potentially quite confusing to people.
Yeah, the gist of it is like the way I had learned it when I in the circles that I was in and the religious community was like, look how amazing Abraham is that he's even willing to kill his son. And that always sat with me in a very strange way that he didn't question it and he just woke up early in the morning and God said to him. And then I was learning with a mentor of mine that I had been studying with for years, and he just kind of gave me a different take on it, which is more of a human perspective. And the first question is like, what does it mean that that he hears the voice of God? What does that mean to hear the voice of God? And then once he hears the voice of God, why is God telling him to sacrifice his son? What does that mean?
Right.
And then what is he going through? He's in 3 days in the desert with his son. And what is that experience like with him as he's walking up the mountain? And what about when his son asks him, you know, here's the blade and here's the thing, but where's the sacrifice, Dad, you know? And I'm thinking what Abraham is going through all that time. And at that stage in his life when he had everything, he had money, he had fame, he had everything. He finally got the son that he wanted. And I'm thinking about what is everyone on the outside world looking at him think? He was the one who said no more human sacrifice. He was the first really to say. So what is the whole world now looking at him thinking, like, this man has lost it, you know, completely lost it. And then he gets up there and, you know, a part of what you don't hear is that, you know, Sarah dies. His wife dies when she finds out that it happened. So, and him and Isaac don't really talk after that. And the angels, they say, are crying in the mystical, in the Kabbalah, they're crying. Isaac goes blind after that because the angels' tears go into his eyes. And they go in two different ways. They end up going, when they come down the mountain, they go to two different places. And there's not much. So there's consequences. There's consequences to all that. And he kind of puts it all out there. And in the end, it, you know, in some ways it works out. He doesn't have to slaughter him. But right. He does
end up giving up something,
doesn't
he?
He gives up. There's a sacrifice. And that is definitely a theme for me in my life and on this record.
Well, I mean, you know, the record is full of, I mean, that song, broken car, broken home, broken house. There are obstacles. There are you know, things, pitfalls to be overcome in a lot of the songs on this record. So was that story kind of just... Was that for you the seed of this record?
Yeah, that was the basis. And that started really before my last record, before Spark Seeker, when I came in here. We had started creating this record, me and this mentor, this friend of mine. His name is Ephraim Rosenstein. And we went together to his great-great-great-whatever grandfather's grave, the Baal Shem Tov, who was the first Hasidic.
Your friend's great 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 grandfather was the Baal Shem Tov.
Yeah, that's correct.
Who is considered to be sort of the founder of the Hasidic movement.
Yeah, like in Martin Buber's, all his stuff. You know, he's the one. He's the one who started the first sort of mystic. So we went to that grave in the Ukraine, and we sat there for 2-3 days, and it's kind of a funny story because when we got there at first, we had a nice little place, and then this group of Hasidim came, and apparently they rent the whole place out for that weekend, so we had no place to stay, and the village, a lot of people in the village were, you know, rent out their homes, but there was none left, so the last place there was the house of this murderer, this fellow whose father was the murderer, town murderer of the Jews in that town before the Nazis came.
Wow.
And was, you know, killing off all the Jews to get their property before. And there, we stayed in that house. There's a huge picture of him on the wall, and his wife was there, like, tending to us. And that's when everything opened up. We had been writing and trying to write and trying to get into it. And when we moved into that house, that's when, like, all of the whole world opened up to us. And, now, and
so you knew when you were staying in that house. The history. You know, I'm glad you explained that, because I noticed in the liner notes where you say, you know, written in the house of a murderer, and I was wondering, what the heck?
I forgot. I guess they left that in. I thought we took that part out.
Okay. No, right there, it's in there, black and white.
Right. Actually, I haven't even seen that CD yet. That's awesome.
It's actually the cover art is kind of striking, a sort of like looking down at you from above, and your hands are sort of cupped almost as if in a kind of yogic position.
Yeah.
And you are studying yoga these days.
A little. I wouldn't go so far as to say studying, but I make my way into a yoga studio here and there, and I do a lot of stretching on my own.
Okay.
Because, I have to be careful what I say because, you know.
Well, you know, there has been a lot of controversy within that community apparently too for people, you know, because some people believe you can't divorce the practice from the spiritual meaning that was originally behind it. And then there are other people who just, it's a good stretch. It gets my cardio going.
Yeah. It's all one thing. You know, like when you're focused on something and you're in the moment, that's the point.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, now, the last time you were here, you know, I mentioned in the intro you tweeted this photo of yourself, you know, newly shorn, and you tweeted the words, "No more Hasidic reggae superstar." Mm. Which struck me when the new record came in, because there you are. You use it twice.
Yeah, you're the best. You pick up on real things. I would just like just to make a comment that every reporter or interviewer in the world should listen to you, because, you know,
It's so such a pleasure to do an interview with you.
I mean, there you are in Watch the Walls Meltdown saying, I'll always be your Hasidic reggae superstar. And then it comes back later in the song Confidence.
Yeah.
So have you made your peace with that term, with people using that term?
Yeah, you got it. It's like when I first was moving out, I wanted to make the point that I'm something beyond that, or that's not all I am. And at this stage, I've sort of like, I feel good about that. You know, I look back on those videos, I look back on that time, and I see the connection that people made with it, you know, and I sort of feel positive about it. You know, like I've moved, you know, full circle kind of like that.
We're speaking with Matas Yahu about his new record, which is called Akeda. He and the band are playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. This song, Surrender, is this, you know, kind of coming out of that same kind of story, that gestation, Abraham surrendering to the will of God?
I mean, yeah, it's a theme that runs throughout, but it's based on, you know, just there was a day that I had, I was in Tel Aviv, and I was in my hotel room, and I was sort of struggling with, like, coming out of my room. And as I was sort of sitting there and looking out the window and looking at the world outside and feeling like how much of my time and my years, the last 10 years, have been spent from behind the glass, from behind an airplane window or a tour bus window or a train or a hotel window, and feeling like I really want to take part in this world out there. But I had this tremendous fear that came over me that was like not letting me go out there. And I saw this sailboat in the ocean with this white sail, like a white flag. And something about that brought me this joy of that there is somebody out there who is not only not afraid to go into the lobby of their hotel, but they're in the middle of the ocean.
Right.
And they've surrendered to, you know, being in this world. And I went down and I jumped in the ocean. And we just made a video for that song, and it was, you know, we're an independent label now, so it was not in the Mediterranean Sea. It was in Lake Michigan in Chicago.
Wow.
And it was 50 degrees.
I was just going to say, that's not nearly as much fun.
Yeah, it was not, but we kind of tried to capture that idea in this video. So.
All right. Well, let's hear the song in a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. My guest is Matas Yahu. The song is called Surrender. It, too, is on the latest Matas Yahu record, the brand new album called Akeda. But once again, he's here in the Soundcheck studio with his band. Here's another live performance.
Go figure, pull the trigger while I simmer in the sun. Tell my lady I'll be with her when the summer's come and gone. But the moon on the rise, you are my tide, you are the one. Sing the song of creation, an anthem for the young in my next life. Could I take another turn? Surrender. Live the life I know why. Dove cries, stars shine, and I fly through the night. My sight sit on the next bet. My life is not set yet. I got no regrets, cause to get where I could, I take another turn, burn another day. Could I move like a prince, slay the dragons in my way? I'll be dancing in the wilderness till my dying day. I'll be dancing on the grave of the brave I have slayed in my next life. With no sight, surrender my vision to your glory.
It's a story of a silent sky, ancient eyes, new baby blues, and old brown horizons. I surrender to your glory. Surrender my vision.
Modest Yahoo singing and beatboxing. The band consists of Rob Marsher at our piano, Stu Brooks on bass, Aaron Dugan on guitar, Joe Tomino behind our drum kit. Modest, a lot in your life has changed. What about your audience? Has the audience changed over the last 3 or 4 years that you can tell?
It's hard to tell. I mean, Spark Seeker was kind of a young record, so I definitely noticed a lot more younger kids at the shows.
Mm-hmm.
One Day definitely took the place of King Without a Crown. I still have fans that are like my age in their mid-30s that like King Without a Crown, but
right.
One Day,
which
is,
was your sort of
that
top
was
40.
The song.
Yeah.
But now One Day is the song. But I think the thing that the tendency is it's people that connect with the spirituality in the music, and that tends to grab people from all walks of life, and even people that are interested in all genres of music,
mm-hmm.
you know.
But it's a double-edged sword, as you have found out. When it's the spirituality that grabs people, you know, that can very easily turn against you if you are perceived as
not
deviating,
being spiritual,
deviating from the path.
Yeah.
Has the audience been kind of a support for you? Has it been something you've kind of wrestled with?
I've wrestled. It's been a wrestling match. Yeah. It's been. There are people that are extremely supportive, and you know, they love the music and connect with it. And then there's people that, you know, they want this, they want that, you know, because I do so many, like, different types of things, and music is such a mix,
right.
So they want more of this, or they want more of that, and it's very hard for me to, I'm learning from Bill Murray. That's who I'm learning how
really?
To deal with this. Yeah, because he's, like, sensitive and vulnerable, but he has the perspective, you know, in his movies, he has
right,
the perspective
right.
that he sees the humor in it all. And I get so worked up and kind of caught in it, you know, it bothers me so much. So I've been watching a lot of Bill Murray movies and trying to, like, figure out how does he do it, you know. He was in my dream last night. I was on I was at his compound, and he sleeps in a trailer, apparently, even though he has a big house in the woods. And he has
is
a ride.
Is that true?
No, this is in my
dream.
This
is your dream, yeah.
And he has a ride, and he was operating the ride, and it was like one of those whipty things that, like, whips you back and forth.
Yeah,
and,
instant whiplash,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Modest Yahoo with us here in the Soundcheck studio with his band. The brand new album is called Akeda. Modest, great to see you again.
Thank you.
feeling down. Can't go any further. Tossed to the ground, been kicked to the curb. Yeah, come against the foe and his ice cream murder. How can I bounce back when I feel so hurt? Yeah, raise your cup to the sky, spread your wings out wide. Champion, na 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 na, champion tonight.
You can watch video of today's session with Matis Yahu and hear one more live song at our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, it's another installment of our series, That Was a Hit, about unlikely chart success stories. We'll scrutinize a number one hit that was not only entirely instrumental, it was also about a satellite. Plus, later on, we'll examine how three super popular movie musicals, Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, and The Sound of Music, actually killed the genre they popularized. We'll find out how later on Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time now for another installment of That Was a Hit, Soundcheck's look at puzzling chart success, and today we are joined by our frequent guest, Chris Melanfi. Hey, Chris.
How are you, John?
Good. Today we're going to look at a number one hit from 1962 by the Tornadoes.
Yes, the Tornadoes, not to be confused with the Texas Tornadoes. That's a different group.
This is a British band?
This is a British band, and that's an important detail because a year, more than a year before the Beatles, they were the first British group to have a number one hit on the Billboard Hot 100 here in the United States.
And that number one hit was?
Telstar.
Telstar.
And if that doesn't sound like the name of a big top 40 hit, that's because it was named after a satellite.
Uh-huh.
Come back with me to the age of the Cold War.
Right.
The year of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's been now several years since America's been quaking in its boots because Sputnik got up in the air before we put anything up in the air. And that summer, a satellite was launched by NASA and AT&T in the summer of 62. And it was the first, this is an important detail because, of course, Americans, we have great pride in our firsts, right? It was the first active direct relay communication satellite as opposed to Sputnik, which didn't actually serve any
useful function.
Useful communications function. Oddly, though this was an American project, this British group named their first big hit after Telstar.
And it actually begins with the sound of a rocket firing.
That's right.
I'll bite. That was a hit?
Seriously, yes.
Where are the words?
Okay, good point. 1962 is also not only a big Cold War year, it's a big year on the U.S. charts, on the Billboard Hot 100, for instrumentals. The 60s in general was a better time for instrumentals. You know, you had all sorts of instrumental hits, everything from the theme from A Summer Place in 1960 to Grazing in the Grass by Hugh Masekela in 1968. Instrumentals used to go to number one, and 62 was the absolute peak. There were three number one instrumental hits in 62. The closest year I could could find anything approaching that was 1975 at the start of disco, where you had songs like The Hustle. But like 62 was really the peak. There was
although even with The Hustle, you had Do the Hustle.
Do the Hustle. Very good point. There were like a couple of words in that song. Yeah. Right. Three pure instrumental number one hits in 1962. The first one is actually sort of statistically important. It's this strange clarinet song by a gentleman who calls himself Mr. Acker Bilk, and it's called Stranger on the Shore. That went to number one earlier in the year. It turned out to be the biggest hit of the year. Mr. Acker Bilk,
never heard of
jazz
him.
Clarinetist
from
England. And the reason I bring that up is he was the first British act of any kind to top the U.S. chart. So first it's him, then it's the Tornadoes, whom we're talking about. In between, there was an instrumental number one hit called The Stripper. If the song that's in your head right now is the one you're picturing, yes, that Stripper by David Rose Orchestra. Instrumental hits in 62.
Wow. So it's instrumental. We mentioned it starts with the sound of a rocket ship firing.
Right.
And then it has this kind of sound of surf guitar.
Totally.
Except there is no guitar. What is that?
Okay, so the main instrument you're hearing is something called a clavioline. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's sort of a battery-powered proto-synthesizer that sounds like an organ crossed with a calliope with a little hint of theremin. And that is actually played by not any of the five nominal members of the group. It's played by the producer, Joe Meek. And he's probably the most important figure. He's the reason this song exists. He wrote the song, he produced the song, and he's a very, very interesting figure. AllMusic calls him legendary, eccentric, and enigmatic. He's a producer who couldn't sing. He had limited playing ability. Reportedly, when he was recording in the studio, he had to, you know, hum or sing, and others would take notation. But he's an important figure in early rock and roll. He's sort of a British Phil Spector, and he's one of the first independent producers. And he's kind of the prime mover behind this record.
And therefore, he was the subject when a plagiarism accusation arose.
That's right. There was a French song called La Marche d'Austerlitz from a 1960 film called Austerlitz. The basic melody is somewhat similar. I'll talk later about how that all turned out, but they did sue him over the melody, which is pretty similar.
Let's listen. So that is La Marche d'Austerlitz from the 1960 film Austerlitz, a French composer who noted a strange familiarity in this big hit from the British band The Tornadoes. Listen again to The Tornadoes' song Telstar. It's the same series of notes.
It's basically that three-note figure you hear, that da, da, da. That's the kind of the core.
Da, da, da,
yes.
Da, da.
Yes.
Except, it. I mean, well, listen.
Yeah.
So that's the Tornadoes, that their song Telstar.
Yep.
I mean, the melody, you know, if you wrote it out on paper, the shape of it would be the same, but the feel is very different.
Very different, yeah.
How did the lawsuit turn out?
The lawsuit turned out in Joe Meek's favor in the end. They found that the similarity was not strong enough to warrant, finding in favor of the French composer.
And yet this story, this kind of story of unexpected success, has a very sad ending.
It does. Joe Meek, for all of his importance to the British music industry, he died, I hate to say it, in a murder-suicide. He actually had a shotgun that he confiscated from one of his band members. And then in a rage, he killed his landlady and then himself. In early 1967. The real tragic irony, he was depressed on a number of levels, but, you know, certainly the Austerlitz lawsuit was one of the things that had him so despondent. The finding in his favor came 3 weeks after his death, which is a really, really sad irony.
So the Tornadoes, a one-hit wonder?
Total one-hit wonder. They appeared on the Hot 100 one more time down in the 60s, but this was it for them. They were an instrumental group. They sometimes backed other groups, but under their own name, this was it for them.
The song Telstar from the Tornadoes, yes, that was a hit. Chris Melanfi, good to see you again.
Always great, John. Thanks.
Up next, we'll hear about the untimely death of the movie musical back in the 1960s, right when it seemed like the genre should have been taking off. I'll talk with the author of the new book called Roadshow, next on Soundcheck.
That a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In a six-month period between 1964 and 65, three movie musicals premiered. Each of the three would sweep across American movie theaters and the Billboard charts. They were Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, and The Sound of Music. They would collectively get 35 Oscar nominations and would end up winning 18. And they effectively killed the movie musical. So says Matthew Kennedy, author of the new book Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. So, fans of musicals, get your torches and pitchforks ready, because Matthew is here with me on Soundcheck. Hi.
Hi, John.
So, three blockbuster classic musicals killed the form. How's that thesis working out for you?
Well, so far it seems to be well supported. That's sort of the basis of the book. The idea was that Hollywood was rather depressed prior to these three films in terms of attendance and revenue and so forth. And so the big splash, the success of these three films in such short time created a kind of avalanche of hope, you might say, in virtually all the major studios that said the next big thing are big splashy musicals.
Right.
So they basically put into the pipeline over a dozen, which is actually a lot in a short period of time, and committed a great amount of money and had huge confidence in them. And with a few stellar exceptions, they were either disappointing in terms of profits or disastrous in terms of lack of profits.
Well, now, let me go back to the title of your book, Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. Roadshow is a specific term in the Hollywood industry.
Yes. It was a very, very big deal in the 1960s and earlier. And it refers to a kind of film distribution and exhibiting where patrons would have to buy reserve seats in advance. These films would be shown in downtown theaters, usually only two screenings a day because the films were so long. And if they were musical roadshows, then they would include an overture, an intermission, an entre-act, and exit music.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd get a souvenir program? You got a souvenir program.
Wow.
They were
so
higher
it was
priced.
Like going, it was like going to a show. It was
yes.
like going to a Broadway show, except it was a film.
Yeah. I mean, the idea was very much to replicate the excitement and the sense of event of going to Broadway or live theater.
Mm-hmm. And so this stuff had been happening with some success in the 40s and 50s, and by the early 60s, it's waning.
Yes. So it was beginning to not quite work in terms of, you know, two or three bombs in a row and a studio was devastated.
Yeah. So these three musicals, My Fair Lady, Mary Poppins, and this one, The Sound of Music, for a brief moment resurrected this Hollywood idea of the roadshow.
With songs they have sung for a thousand years. The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. My heart wants to sing every song it hears. My heart wants to beat like the wings of the birds that rise from the lake to the trees. My heart wants to sigh like a chime that flies from a church on a breeze.
Julie Andrews, of course, in The Sound of Music, one of the big three movie musicals that took over the country, really, both, as you point out, Matthew, both in the movie theaters and the Billboard charts. I mean, the three soundtracks for My Fair Lady, Mary Poppins, Sound of Music were... they were behemoths. They
yes.
were hugely
I mean,
successful.
Yes, both as films and as recordings. And The Sound of Music was the number one box office film for several years. Reached that in 1966.
Now, you write somewhere, I think it's early in the book, about how as an adult you have come to realize that a lot of the things you loved as a kid are actually not very good.
Mm.
What about these three? I mean, you could say... the story of Mary Poppins is too thin to support a 2.5-hour film. You could say My Fair Lady is just a bunch of obvious sets, one set piece after another, and Audrey Hepburn doesn't fit the part. You can say that Sound of Music is really sentimental and treacly. Having said all of those things, they're considered classics.
That's true. I mean, I think those criticisms are all valid, and they all somehow speak to mass audiences still to this day. All three of them are part of the sing-along phenomenon today, where people seem to enjoy the sort of camp nostalgia aspects of these films because they stylistically they part so much from what we now take in as movies today.
Yeah, but now here's the nut of your book. You can say that now, that this was the last hurrah, but Hollywood thought, oh, this is the first flowering of a...
Exactly, a great new beginning. Yeah.
So what happened next?
Well, it seems as though Hollywood got a little bit overzealous in the demand for musicals of this sort. So you have simply a glutting of the market in terms of the number of roadshows and you know, movies that would have required advanced planning in terms of reservations and so forth. I mean, in 1967, there were something like 8 roadshows toward the end of the year. And that's a lot of calculating to do when you just want a night's entertainment, you
right.
know, and it's ultimately not live.
And again, you had to reserve tickets in advance at a specific theater at a specific time. It wasn't like, hey, see what's playing down
right.
the road, you know?
Well, yeah.
Now, so... Among much of your book is just regaling us with tales of bloated budgets, bloated actors, you know, behaving badly offset, sometimes on set. One of the musicals that the studios commit to is Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And a recurring theme in your book is people are stuck in these musicals even if they themselves are not very musical.
That is correct. And I don't use this term in the book, but we might call it the Rex Harrison syndrome, which is that if it worked for Rex Harrison and My Fair Lady, then it's going to work for Peter O'Toole and Goodbye, Mr. Chips. So O'Toole gives actually, I think, a brilliant performance in that film when he's not singing.
Mm-hmm.
When he is singing, the majesty of his voice is lost. And what remains is a kind of wispy account of sentimentality, which of course isn't aided much by the fact that the lyrics are not I'm trying to be delicate.
Not the most poetic?
Not the most poetic or penetrating or emotionally resonant.
Let's hear Peter O'Toole in action, so to speak. What a Lot of Flowers from the musical movie Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
What a lot of flowers. What a lot of sunshine. What a lot of beauty in the world today. What a world of color just beyond my window. Flowers every color of the rainbow. Red roses, orange marigolds, yellow buttercups, green leaves, blue cornflowers, indigo lilacs, and violets, violets. My happy eye perceives.
Peter O'Toole in the film Goodbye, Mr. Chips, singing What a Lot of Flowers. And so how did they do that?
Well, because O'Toole was not a trained singer, there was actually multiple splicing of very brief phrases in this song, and then they were cobbled together in, you know, in post-production. So it appears as though he's singing continuously, but it's actually several dozen, I believe, individual sound bites.
With all the time and money that that implies, you know, a staff of recording engineers and editors and such. Matthew Kennedy is the author of the new book, Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s, out now from the Oxford University Press, and it talks about how Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, and The Sound of Music were not the start of something big, they were the end of something big for Hollywood. But Hollywood didn't know that. And so under the weight of huge budgets and huge expectations, inevitably, as you point out, artistic decisions give way to commercial decisions.
Yes, yes. And actually, one of the commercial decisions that was made repeatedly, including Goodbye, Mr. Chips, is the idea that a movie star is going to carry a movie musical whether or not they have musical credentials. So rather than hire, say, the Broadway original or a movie star who also is musically gifted, someone like Peter O'Toole, again, will be able to get by with the Rex Harrison syndrome. Also, Lee Marvin in Paint Your Wagon, Vanessa Redgrave in Camelot.
Clint Eastwood
in Paint Your Wagon. Yes.
All right. Now, this is the second time you've mentioned the Rex Harrison syndrome. Explain that to me.
Well, again, I don't use that term in the book, but it's the I'd say it's the idea that Rex Harrison was so good at talk singing, and it made such an indelible impression in My Fair Lady that perhaps that technique would simply spill over into other films and become actually a style of its own that could extend beyond Harrison. So you have Richard Harris performs rather similarly in Camelot, and Harrison again sort of mimics himself from My Fair Lady in Dr. Doolittle.
This is Rex Harrison with a song from My Fair Lady called A Hymn to Him.
Yes, why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so honest, so thoroughly square, eternally noble, historically fair, who when you win will always give your back a pat. Why can't a woman be like that? Why does everyone do what the others do? Can't a woman learn to use her head? Why do they do everything their mothers do? Why don't they grow up, well, like their father instead? Why can't a woman take after a man? Men are so pleasant, so easy to please. Whenever you're with them, you're always at ease. Would you be slighted if I didn't speak for hours?
Of course not.
You'd be livid if I had a drink or two?
Nonsense.
Would you be wounded if I never sent you flowers?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like you?
All right, so there's Rex Harrison, Matthew, in My Fair Lady, hugely successful, and he's successful in it with this kind of speech singing thing. So successful that what happens with Dr. Doolittle?
He sort of slipped into a Henry Higgins mode again from My Fair Lady. I make the claim that it was sort of in his bloodstream by then. I'm not sure he couldn't evoke Henry Higgins, given how long he had played that role.
And certainly the studio wanted Henry Higgins. They wanted the success of Henry Higgins, and what they got was this from Dr. Doolittle.
Why do we treat animals like animals? Animals treat us so very well. The devoted way they serve us and protect us when we're nervous. Oh, they really don't deserve us. All we give them is hell. Tell me, how else man repays them? Do we ever think to praise them? No, we don't, and this dismays them, you can tell. We're riddled with ingratitude. We give no love or latitude. In every way, our attitude is, well, like animals.
Like Animals from Dr. Doolittle, once again Rex Harrison, not just reprising the method of delivery, but that song is very, very similar to the one we heard from My Fair Lady.
Yes, absolutely.
Look, it's the 60s. Times are tough. The real Camelot, the JFK White House, you know, has ended in tragedy. We're mired in a war in Southeast Asia. And you might look at that and say, well, people need the escapism of a movie musical. And clearly Hollywood was thinking that way. Meanwhile, what's happening out in the real world?
Well, out in the real world, just as you said, John, there's in 1968, there were two huge political assassinations. There was Vietnam. There was the election of Richard Nixon. There were race riots. I mean, the late 60s, as we all know, were a time of great tumult in the United States. And in some respects, the studio's commitment to these musicals makes sense as alternatives to the rough world outside. But the most popular films of the day were actually sort of were veering toward a realism.
Yeah, and as you point out, while they're making Camelot and Dr. Doolittle, the Beatles are releasing Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
So, you know, the generation is changing and somebody's not seeing that.
Right. There's this, you know, with the musicals that had these huge budgets, there seemed to have been almost an avoidance or a denial of contemporary sound.
So as we head on into the 70s and things do fall apart, these musicals are seen as kind of hokey, old-fashioned, you know, not really relevant. Although in the 70s, as you point out in the book, I think you use the phrase that Grease was the exception that proved the rule. So it somehow shows that, you know, nostalgia is still a powerful tool.
Yeah, there was a taste for nostalgia in the 70s, and Grease as a film shows up in 1978 and hugely capitalizes on perhaps boomer nostalgia for the 50s and their childhood.
Yeah.
And Grease becomes one of the great musical hits of all time.
And is it the exception that proves the rule because it is so exceptional, because there were no other movie musicals being made around that time?
There were actually musicals being made. They never really died. What happened with musicals, I'd say, is that they became part of a niche market. So you have smaller budget musicals that are appealing to very specific audiences. And Grease is the one that seems to transcend
a
limited audience and, you know, has huge return patrons and so forth.
A little bit from the soundtrack to the film Grease.
If you're filled with affection, you're too shy to convey it. Meditate my direction. Feel your way.
Wow!
Better shape up, cause you need the best.
Some of the music from Grease from 1978. So movie musicals could still happen. This is like 13 years after the big three, Matthew, that you write about. Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, The Sound of Music. Matthew Kennedy's book is called Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. It's out now. Matthew's with me here on Soundcheck. And I'm sure every parent listening right now is going to be saying, but what about Disney? You know,
yeah, right.
Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Lion King, Beauty and the Beast. You know, these were movie musicals.
Yes, and there certainly have been flurries of activity of the musical genre since the 1960s and early 70s, absolutely, just as Disney, as you mentioned, and also a revival of live-action musicals in the wake of Chicago and the success of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there are individual film musicals that actually still do very well. Les Mis made buckets of money, so did Mamma Mia and Hairspray as films. But it doesn't feel to me like the genre is fully back with us. It's not like the early 50s and late 40s where there was quite literally on American screens a new musical every week.
Mm-hmm.
And it was coming out from MGM or Fox or whomever.
And it dominated the pop charts, too.
And it dominated
That's where
the,
all
right.
our pop songs came
there was
from.
There was a connection, a strong connection between pop songs and film musicals. Now, the theory has been that relationship was somewhat severed or compromised with the advent of rock and roll.
Right.
And it's never quite been reintegrated.
Matthew Kennedy's book is called Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. And Matthew, it's been great fun talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John.
And the fears that once controlled me can't get to me at all. It's time to see what I can do to test the
Tomorrow on the show, Warren Haynes has played with members of the Grateful Dead. He is the frontman of the Allman Brothers Band, and he leads his own rock group, Government Mule. He visits the studio by himself to play a solo electric version of a couple of his songs and to talk about his decades-long career. Plus, we'll speak with entertainment mogul Shep Gordon, who's profiled in the new movie, Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, directed by none other than Mike Myers. Marco Benevento wrote our theme song. It's called Eagle Rock, and you can find out more about Marco on our website, soundcheck.org. Don't forget to join us on Saturday night at BAM. It's part of Radio Love Fest. Our guests will include comic Wyatt Cenac, with live music from Hamilton Lighthouser of the Walkmen and the band San Fermin. For tickets, go to bam.org/radiolovefest. That's Saturday night at BAM. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.